Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I'm very pleased to be joined for this particular segment of our program by a man who actually served in military intelligence and has, since taking off his uniform as a lieutenant colonel in the United States Army, gone on to bring a lot of intelligence to bear on the various challenges we're facing around the world, notably these days, from an old nemesis, the Kremlin, now under the stewardship of Vladimir Putin. He is Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters, United States Army retired. You see him frequently at Fox News, read his columns at the New York Post and elsewhere. He is always welcome here, and most especially on the occasion of having a lot to talk about Russia in Syria, Ukraine, and elsewhere. Colonel, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Hey, great to speak with you, Frank. I got to tell you, you know, just this morning I was thinking about the most wrong-headed book in all of history. Remember a quarter of a century ago when Francis Fukuyama, who's not a bad guy, published a book called The End of History, predicting that peace would break out and that democracy would triumph overall. History doesn't end. And that's a problem that the Obama class and the Kerry class of people who went to the right prep schools but never went to the school of hard knocks, they don't understand that history doesn't end. Russia is continuous. There are ruptures. There are eruptions of violence, but it always returns to the center of gravity, to being Russia. And Putin is a classic great Russian in the mold of Ivan Grozny, Ivan the Terrible, and Peter the Great. He's not a communist. No, interesting. He was a KGB guy. He knows it didn't work. But boy, he wants to reestablish Russia's grandeur and greatness as he sees it. And thanks to our absolute surrender on all fronts, this guy, Putin, chronically underestimated by all Western leaders who did go to the right prep schools, he is changing history. I mean, Frank, you know very well, you know the Russian scene. Back around the turn of the millennium, he took over a country that was decayed, diseased, impoverished, with a few pockets of oligarch wealth, with a rusting, you know, worthless military. And in 15 years, Vladimir Putin has turned it at least into the semblance, the superficial semblance of a great power again. He's humiliated the West again and again. The single reverse he suffered in 15 years was when the Ukrainian people rose up and threw out the Ukrainian president Putin thought he'd bought fair and square. But other than that, whether it's Georgia, Crimea, Ukraine, now Syria, the West backs down.
He's running the table, yeah. And Ralph, you know, that one episode in which he was repulsed, he's been getting even for ever since, needless to say. And Ralph, again, you're the author of some 30 books on a whole host of subjects, both fiction and nonfiction, including among the most recent, Cain at Gettysburg. But you had an appreciation of the dynamic of history, which is not just that bad guys do bad things, but that bad guys are inspired and emboldened and enabled to do bad things when good guys do the kinds of things we're doing at the moment.
Yeah, now history, you know, which the left has taken out of our schools, except for some nonsense about Sojourner Truth or this or that. History doesn't give you a blueprint to the future, but it helps you avoid mistakes. And just as a classic example, you know, I've just been rereading Julian Corbett, the old British naval theorist. His description of how England blundered into what we call the French and Indian War under a weak Newcastle government that very much resembled the Obama administration is classic. I mean, history does repeat itself, and it does repeat itself as farce. So while it doesn't have all the answers, if you want to be a statesman, if you want to deal with the Iranians, if you want to deal with the Russians, you had better have a fundamental grasp of historical fact, not left-wing nonsense a la Howard Zinn, and not Parson Weems or conservative views either. Factual history. And Obama doesn't have it, and Kerry doesn't have it.
No, and unfortunately, there isn't a whole lot of evidence that Republican leaders have it either, alas. I'm hoping that some will emerge yet in this presidential election, but unfortunately, they seem to be largely being drowned out by Donald Trump. I wanted to ask you about one thing that you wrote recently, Ralph, in one of your essays that caught my eye. You argue that Putin is positioning himself as in the, quote, vanguard of the struggle against fanatical Islam, unquote. And I just wanted to drill down on that for a moment.
Yeah, he's positioning himself, but he's not sincere.
Well, and I just wonder if he's allied with Iran, which he certainly seems to be at the moment, at least in terms of propping up their shared ally, Bashar Assad. That's a fairly significant element of fanatical Islam, is it not, the Iranian Republic?
But again, that you've got to understand Russia's internal dynamics and history. Iran is Shia. They're Shia Muslims. Overwhelmingly, the problems Russians have had down the centuries have been with Sunni Muslims. Putin has made a conscious decision to ally himself with Shia Islam in Iran, in Iraq, in Western Afghanistan, with the Alawite minority, which is related to Shia in Syria, Bashar al-Assad's an Alawite, with Hezbollah, which is Shia in Lebanon. So, I mean, it's amazing to me that our media, and certainly the politicians, all miss something that's very obvious. He's picked a side in the great Islamic civil war and decided, well, you know, Sunnis have sided with the left, with the West, too often, despite the radicalism of Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. They've been a problem for us in the Caucasus and elsewhere and, you know, throughout the centuries. So he has taken a clear side, and he is trying to build, in cooperation with his Iranian allies, a wall of Shia-dominated, Iranian-dominated states from western Afghanistan through Iran, through Iraq, through Syria and Lebanon to the Mediterranean Sea. And that wall of Shia-dominated states, friendly to Russia, hostile to the U.S., will overshadow the Persian Gulf Sunni Emirates, will overshadow Saudi Arabia, and even Israel. And Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel has already been making pilgrimages to Moscow to suck up to Putin because he knows he can't count on Obama. We are, with a minimum expenditure of force, an absolute minimum, with all bluff, Vladimir Putin is changing the world as our president takes a nap.
You know, one of the things, though, that I do believe very strongly is that while there is unquestionably great animosity between Sunnis and Shia Muslims, you've got an underlying reality, which I have the feeling may cause Putin grief over time, at least, and that is that they will make common cause, as we've seen them do against us.
I don't think so. I just don't.
Well, they for sure have, Ralph. They for sure have.
I understand what you're saying, but people anywhere, theoretically, they hate a distant enemy, but they prefer to kill their neighbors.
No, but it's the infidel enemy in particular that has a special place in the Islamic tradition.
But the Sunnis regard the Shia as infidel.
Well, they do, but not as much as us.
No, there will be times. There will be times when the Shias and Sunnis both, I mean, they certainly both hate us. But I'm just saying that you're unlikely to see, in my view, and you may be right, I may be wrong, you're unlikely to see a united Shia and Sunni front. That's like getting the Black Panthers and the KKK together.
But there are times when they have waged war against us, at 9/11
sure,
being an example of it. And I would be worrying a little bit if I were Putin. But I would also, if I were Putin, be worrying about what he's doing to build up the Chinese as well. Very quickly, Ralph, and we don't have enough time to do justice to this, but if you had, in a minute, an opportunity to tell President Obama what he should be doing about what Putin is up to at the moment in Syria and elsewhere, what would it be?
Well, the first thing is to make it very clear that our aircraft will fly anywhere, anytime over Syria. They will have liberal rules of engagement. And that's a big worry for me, Frank. I'm afraid we're restricting our rules of engagement so that our pilots can't even defend themselves. And I would make very sure that those aircraft of ours had air-to-air missiles and air-to-ground anti-radar missiles visible under their wings so that Putin knows you don't screw with us. Because my biggest fear right now, the tactical fear, is that Putin will shoot down a U.S. drone or an Allied or U.S.-manned aircraft just to humiliate us. And he'll say, oh, it was an accident. We didn't deconflict. We asked you to deconflict. And Obama will leap on that excuse and our military will lose all credibility in the region.
Ralph Peters, altogether too short a conversation. I hope you'll join us again for a longer one soon. I appreciate all the work that you have done, both in uniform, of course, and as well in terms of the work you're about now at Fox and the New York Post and elsewhere. Hell or Richmond, I believe, is the latest book, but I can't keep up. Check them all out, folks.
The latest one's Valley of the Shadows.
Valley of the Shadows. There we go. Keep it up, my friend. We'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, another intelligence professional, Fred Flights, joins us to talk about the politicization of intelligence under the Obama administration. What it might mean for you, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by another intelligence professional, Fred Flights, my colleague at the Center for Security Policy, where he's our senior vice president for policy and programs. But he spent most of his professional career to date in the intelligence business, in the Central Intelligence Agency for about 20 years, working for John Bolton as his chief of staff at the State Department, and not least as a member of the professional staff of the Intelligence Committee of the House of Representatives. Fred, welcome back. It's always good to have you with you, my friend.
Good to be here, Frank.
You had a very important piece, Fred, that appeared at the securefreedom.org website this week about whistleblowers at the Central Command. And the whistle that they were blowing had to do with the politicization of intelligence with respect to the Islamic State and our campaign against them. Talk a little bit about that episode, and then we'll visit about some other instances in which there were also signs of politicization of intelligence without the whistleblowing.
Well, this is really a fascinating development. 50 Defense Department intelligence analysts, probably mostly from the Defense Intelligence Agency, lodged complaints with the Pentagon Inspector General that their analysis on U.S. efforts to battle ISIS had been doctored to make it look like the strategy was succeeding. And, I mean, this was just extraordinary that so many intelligence analysts would come forward to make such a thing, especially at the Pentagon, where their careers are really at risk. So I think this is a very significant development, but as we'll discuss in a few moments, I'm afraid it's not unusual.
And Fred, there have been reports that Jim Clapper, the director of National Intelligence, had been in touch with the intelligence chief for Central Command on a daily basis. Could that have had something to do with this, given the track record of Jim Clapper in, say, politicizing things like the nature of the Muslim Brotherhood, for example?
I think it's very likely. He's the director of National Intelligence, and as I concluded in the Wall Street Journal, concluded in a similar piece, the director of National Intelligence has been watering down and politicizing intelligence for a long time. It's one reason why I think the DNI should be done away with.
Fred, remind us about his comments about the Muslim Brotherhood, because that was really such a wake-up call as to how either grossly incompetent Jim Clapper is or how much he's serving at the direction of the president with respect even to altering the nature of our understanding of the threats we face.
That's the purpose of my point, Frank, to say this incidence of these defense department analysts, it is the tip of the iceberg of politicization of the intelligence under this administration. And a good example is when Clapper told the House Intelligence Committee during a hearing that the Muslim Brotherhood was some kind of social welfare organization. It was not a terrorist group.
Largely secular.
And largely secular. And I just remember seeing mouths dropping open by Democrats and Republicans when he said that, and he had to walk it back. But the question here is, you know, why weren't there whistleblowers on that? He was reading from notes. This was the consensus position of the intelligence community that was deliberately playing down the threat from the Muslim Brotherhood across all 17 intelligence agencies. Where were those whistleblowers?
And the truth of the matter is that this was very much in the service of, if not at the direction of, the president's effort to legitimate and embrace and empower an organization that anybody with any knowledge of the group at all understands is rabidly hostile to us and a threat to boot. Fred, this was one of several instances you referred to in your piece in which there was politicizing going on. And I want to just capture a couple of others. Just talk for a moment about the, I think it was the 2011 National Intelligence Estimate of Iran, wasn't it? Or was it earlier than that?
There was an estimate in 2007 and in 2011, and they were both heavily politicized. I might add to 2007 NIE, which Alan Dershowitz and a former CIA director referred to as stupid intelligence, were written by the DNI people, and the DNI people were on detail from the State Department.
So we've seen it happening, as you say, across the various agencies of the government. My own experience was that the State Department's Office of Intelligence and Research was really the most politicized of the whole bunch, but certainly with the Director of National Intelligence under Jim Clapper playing this kind of role, it's a menace, frankly. But talk about the briefing that you had just recently at the CIA's headquarters.
Well, the best examples I give and the most disturbing concern politicization of analysis of Iran, I sat through a long briefing by a senior official who works on WMD analysis, and he said his presentation wasn't going to take a position on the Iran deal. And he gave what basically could have been taken from White House talking points. He didn't mention how funds released to Iran under the deal go to terrorism. He didn't mention the secret side deals. He didn't mention criticism of it at all. It was a propaganda speech, and there were mistakes concerning uranium enrichment and plutonium production that the White House has repeatedly made that no bona fide arms control expert would have made. I was really ashamed for this guy.
Arms control expert is bad enough, but most especially an intelligence analyst who's supposed to be just looking at the facts, as, of course, you did for a long time, Fred Flights, in this particular portfolio. So you've asked the question, where are the whistleblowers? They don't seem to be present much. Why is that, Fred? And what might be done to encourage, well, not just whistleblowing, but really a return to objective analysis and reporting on the facts as they exist by the intelligence community?
Well first, you and I know this is an historic problem that goes back many years. The Nixon administration complained about it, Reagan, the Bush administration. So we know that there is a propensity of these analysts to side towards academia, because that's where a lot of them come from, or that's where a lot of them want to work someday. And I know recently that there has been real pressure on analysts, with promotions and bonuses and good assignments being withheld if they don't toe the company line. What we're looking at here is a situation where we need real leadership, someone like Bill Casey, to come in and shake the place up, tell analysts, and when I was an analyst, when I was hired, I always said, call him like you see him, dare to be wrong, and look beyond the evidence. That's what the president needs for us to deal with the situation we have today, with a lot of new threats that hadn't been thought of before. The bureaucracy has to be confronted. And remember what happened when Porter Grosch tried to do this in the Bush administration. CIA fought back, and unfortunately, the Bush administration didn't have his back, and he lost his job. The next president has to do better.
Fred, just on that point, you said look beyond the facts. I think what you're really getting at is take the facts to their logical conclusion.
I'm sorry, I meant look beyond the evidence. Basically, intuition by an analyst is valuable. I don't mean making stuff up, but basically sometimes a policymaker says, what does this mean? And right now we have a situation where analysts aren't allowed to draw conclusions where they don't have a source. Sometimes you have to look beyond the evidence to look forward to see what does this mean? What will happen in the future? And we're not letting analysts do that anymore because we're gun shy because of what happened with the Iraq war analysis.
Well, it does seem to me that this has to be fact-based, obviously. It has to be evidence-based, and I think that's what you're saying. But it is about taking things to their logical conclusion based on the available information, which is generally not complete, alas. We're not omniscient. Fred, one other thing that you mentioned in this piece at securefreedom.org, and I commend all of Fred's work, National Review Online and elsewhere, to our audience. But you talk about competitive analysis as something that Bill Casey was keen on. Is that still an element of the way we do the intelligence business? And if not, should it be?
No, I'm afraid we read analysis based on consensus among 17 intelligence agencies. It's watered-down analysis written by committee, and it's just terrible. What Casey did is that he had competing offices writing on the same subject and forcing them to take dissenting comments in their work. And there was basically tribal warfare almost every day on certain subjects. But that way, when the policymaker got an analysis, he said, well, there's several perspectives here. I'll decide which one I agree with, rather than getting this watered-down mush that was written by committee, which is what we're doing today.
Fred Flights, you've been doing this brilliantly for a long time, both in government and now with us at the Center for Security Policy. We very much enjoy our visits with you each week and look forward to the one next week. Thanks for the work you're doing. In the meantime, keep it up. We're going to talk next with two members of the Intelligence Committee in the United States House of Representatives, starting with Congressman Chris Stewart. Get his take on this politicization, Russia, and more. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom. With Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. One might have been forgiven for thinking that the negative effects of President Obama's nuclear deal with Iran would take some time to begin manifesting themselves in the Middle East. The past few days' developments in Syria, however, offer a foretaste of what's ahead. Russia's deployed military forces to Syria in support of that country's dictator Bashar Assad, Moscow's longtime ally and Iran's. They've set up a joint command center in our erstwhile Iraqi protectorate and begun combat operations against Assad's opponents, starting with targets not associated with the Islamic State. Then yesterday, the Kremlin demanded a halt to U.S. and allied air attacks against the IS caliphate. In other words, even before Iran gets the Obama bomb deal's $150 billion, Tehran and its friends are emboldened, on the march, and more dangerous than ever. Stop the deal. This is Frank Gaffney. Learn more at irontruth.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back and joined by one of my all-time favorite members of the House of Representatives. He's Representative Chris Stewart. He represents with great distinction, and I really mean that, the people of the 2nd District of Utah. A man with a distinguished record in any number of capacities, notably as a command pilot in the United States Air Force, a record-setting pilot at that, and a New York Times best-selling author, to say nothing of a distinguished member of Congress serving on the House Intelligence and Appropriations Committees. Congressman Stewart, welcome back. It's great to have you, sir.
It's always be good to stay, Frank. Thank you, Frank.
Listen, I have to just get your take on the sweepstakes at the moment. The House leadership, as we speak, is up for grabs. What are your thoughts on where we are today and where we might find ourselves a week from today when the vote is taken?
Yeah, I think everyone's pretty comfortable that Kevin McCarthy is going to be the future Speaker of the House. I know that he has, one person who's opposing him, but I think there's an overwhelming support for Kevin, although there's some question about whether, and I've been asked this 1,000 times, is why I want to mention it. People say, well, is there going to be a change of tone, a change of process from what we saw with the previous speaker? And I think some people wonder that. But I think the more interesting races are obviously what's happened is the majority leader and then the whip. And I really couldn't predict that at this point. I think it's quite fluid. And anyone who tells you that they know who the next House leader is going to be, I just don't think that's right. I just don't think we know it this time.
Also, you recently voted against the continuing resolution for reasons that, as I understand it, had partly to do with policy, but also to do with process. And I wanted to focus on the process piece of this. How is it that we continue to find ourselves falling back to these continuing resolutions, which, as we'll be talking with one of your colleagues shortly, Congressman Winstrup in the Armed Services Committee, is having a terrible effect on military programs and plans, as you know. What's up with that?
Many of us are extraordinarily frustrated with the fact that we go to these CRs, and it brings us to the precipice of these government shutdowns that people worry about. It creates, I think, distrust in the government by just normal folks. But the thing that I object to as well is, as someone who sits on the House Appropriations Committee, who sat in hearings and markups that sometimes went hours and hours, 6-7 hours, and the House did our work. We passed our 12 appropriations bills out of that committee, and the Senate refuses to pass any of them. None. Zero. And the minority leader there, Harry Reid, says we'll filibuster any appropriations process. And that brings us to this point where you know, we have no way of going forward other than this bad idea of continuing resolutions, which all of that work that we did, and much of that, Frank, have policy writers in there that are very helpful if you're trying to take power away from Washington, D.C., if you're trying to reduce our spending, if you're trying to, in some cases, like I think is important, increase our military and allow the military the flexibility to spend the money the way they need to, all of that goes away when we have this continuing resolution.
Which I guess is the idea, as far as Harry Reid is concerned, that they managed to preserve for the president the latitude that you're rightly trying to restrict and that I think so many of us hope you will succeed at. A travesty, to say the least. Congressman, let me talk about another travesty. In the previous segment, I was discussing with Fred Flights, who served previously on the Intelligence Committee in the House in which you serve. And he was warning about this problem of the politicization of intelligence. As you know, 50 whistleblowers have raised a concern specifically about what's been going on in CENTCOM lately with respect to the Islamic State. Any thoughts on that particular sort of micro example? But more generally, do you see this as a problem with what's happening with intelligence overall?
Well, let me say this. I'm concerned. In fact, I spoke with General Stewart about that yesterday, and I've spoken with others as well. And if I could say two things quickly. One of them is this. If you talk to me about Social Security, if you talk to me about tax policy, if you talk to me about any number of things, as a witness or as an expert, I can tell. I know immediately if you're telling me the truth or if you're seeing something that isn't right. But when you talk about intelligence, we have to rely upon these analysts. We don't know without being able to trust them. And I tell you, I've walked out of some hearings, closed door, highly sensitive, highly classified hearings. I've turned to the person next to me and said, I don't think they're being honest with us. I don't think we're getting a straight scoop. We're getting a very heavy administration view in some of these cases and from some of these analysts. And I've noticed it for months now. And we just can't do that. You have to be able to trust these guys.
And to the extent that you are charged on the House Intelligence Committee with overseeing the intelligence community, I pray that this will be an issue that the committee will address itself to, again, not just in this microcosmic example, but as Fred Flights was saying, Congressman Stewart, this was so evident in a lot of what was going on with respect to the Iran deal, as you know, and you fought it so hard. Let me turn to yet another subject that I know you're concerned about. You've spent a lot of time in the Air Force in the Middle East. We're now watching the spectacle of Vladimir Putin's air forces now not only operating in Syria, but telling ours not to operate there. Give us your read on what's happening at the moment with respect specifically to Syria, but more broadly, what Russia's up to and how much of concern it should be to all of us.
Oh, my heavens, Frank. Do you have 10 hours?
Alas, not. But I'd love to come back to you for more.
You're going to have to, because that's how long it's going to take to talk about this. I mean, it makes my head want to explode. I actually am speechless about some of this. 2 weeks ago, when Russia started to move military forces into there, and the narrative from the administration and others was, including the press, Russia joins fight against ISIL. And I said, that's insane. That is not the reason they're there. They are there to prop up Bashar al-Assad. They're there in conjunction and working with the Iranians to back up Bashar al-Assad. They say, yeah, we're going to fight the terrorists. Well, their definition of terrorists are anyone who opposes Bashar al-Assad. And that's exactly what they're doing. It is exactly contrary to the stated U.S. goal for years now for the removal of the Syrian president. And to watch the passivity, the absolute stick your head in the sand response from this president, and from Secretary Kerry and from the Defense Secretary. I can't wrap my arms around that. I think, how could you defend this and not stand up against this? But they're not. And it's going to completely weaken. It's going to isolate the United States. It's going to insert Russia as the most important force, the most important nation in that incredibly delicate part of the world. And there is no good news in this at all.
Colonel Ralph Peters was our guest in the first segment. We talked with him about what Russia may be trying to do in terms of fashioning kind of a Shiite crescent, if you will, stretching from basically the Mediterranean to Central Asia as kind of a buffer for it itself against the Sunnis, their brand of Islamic extremism. But the concern that I imagine you have as well is in the process of making common cause, not just with Bashar Assad, but with Iran, and even with the Shiite government of Iraq, notably with this intelligence command center in Baghdad these days, that Russia is positioning itself to be a long-term presence in the Middle East, presumably at the expense of our interests and allies as well.
There's no question that's true, and it didn't take a prophet to see this coming. Many of us have been saying this for years now, and it starts with this premise, and this goes back to, you know, to the very beginning of this administration, this idea of leading from behind. I defy anyone to even tell me what that means. It's impossible. You don't lead the charge from behind, and that's what this president has tried to do, and it's led to chaos. And it's led to, I would say, darkness and confusion in these very important parts of the world. And Russia looked at that and said, okay, the U.S. is going to withdraw their influence. We will step in. Had the U.S. maintained our presence, had we maintained our power structures in Iraq and across the region, had we maintained our influence and our power projection there, Russia would not have challenged us. But when we withdraw that influence and we leave this vacuum, absolutely Russia's going to step in. They care what happens in that part of the world. They want to influence what happens in that part of the world. And their interests and the U.S. interests do not align. And I think it's going to take a generation for us to fix this. I really do. It's going to take so long for us to back out of this and to make it better.
And as we'll be talking about with your colleague, Congressman Winstrup, when you add on top of that, another piece that I know you're also very concerned about, and that is the hollowing out of our military, we may not have a generation. Congressman, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your time today, as well as our interactions off air and all of the work you do on Capitol Hill. I hope you'll keep it up and come back to us again very soon. And in the meantime, we will be speaking with Congressman Brad Winstrup about the Armed Services Committee's National Defense Authorization Act and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I lost my healthy 27-year-old son to influenza. Jacob wasn't someone you'd expect to die from the flu. He was strong, a martial arts athlete. After 5 weeks of fighting, Jacob died.
I'm Dr. Bill Schaffner of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Each year, influenza claims the lives of Americans of all ages, including healthy young adults like Jacob. Ask about vaccination the next time you're at your doctor's office or pharmacy. Visit adultvaccination.org.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I couldn't be more pleased to say, joined by yet another member of the House Intelligence Committee, Congressman Brad Winstrup. He is also a member of the House Armed Services Committee and the Committee on Veterans Affairs. Appropriately enough, as he is a member of the United States Army Reserves, now holding the rank of lieutenant colonel, a medical doctor by training, a combat surgeon in Iraq, as a matter of fact, as well, and a distinguished member of the House of Representatives representing the people of the 2nd District of Ohio. Congressman, welcome back. It's great to have you with us, sir.
Thank you, Frank. Appreciate it.
I was talking with your colleague, Chris Stewart, a moment ago about the appropriations process that is seriously broken, it seems, thanks to Harry Reid and the Senate Democrats. This has real implications, as you know so well, for the various programs of the Defense Department, but most especially those that need to have new starts or to ramp up over what they did the last year. Could you talk a little bit about that and, you know, how you see the way forward in terms of trying to help the Defense Department meet its requirements?
Well, you know, first of all, let's start with the notion and the fact that the number one priority today for Americans is their security. This has become their greatest concern and their lack of trust in the American government. And I think they have plenty of good reasons. We have got to put forward and get through our bill, the National Defense Authorization Act. We have to provide at least some certainty to the military of what they can and cannot do as we move forward. And unfortunately, they keep getting it in short bits, and it's very difficult to plan and defend this nation if we're doing things that way. It's very frustrating, as you know that it's very frustrating.
Speaking of the National Defense Authorization Act, and again, for those not intimately familiar with the ways of Congress, the authorization takes place theoretically before the appropriations and sort of sets the ceilings and broad policy guidance, and then the appropriators are supposed to flesh it out with the funding. But where are we with respect to what has been, as I understand it, a repeated threat by the president to veto this Defense Authorization Act now that you've gotten it through conference?
Well, that's the last that we heard, is he intends to veto it, and I don't know if he's paying attention to what's going on in the world and what has been going on with our military, and we cannot afford any further setbacks. We hear it time and time again from our military leaders that we are putting ourselves in more and more danger, and I think it sends a signal to our adversaries that the president isn't serious about our defense if he's saying he would veto this. And not proceed with giving our military some certainty and some direction.
I couldn't agree with you more. And in various places, it's obvious that he doesn't want the direction, notably, I think, with respect to not closing down Guantanamo Bay and some impediments to the idea of putting women into combat positions and the like. And for all these reasons, it seems to me, as well as authorizing more expenditure on the defense projects of the nation, that that fight is one we ought to have. And if he does decide to veto it, so be it.
You know, when we say ready, aim, fire, when we say ready, it's supposed to be a command, not a question mark. It's not supposed to be a question. We need to be ready. We need to be ready for what comes our way, and we have to address realistically. And you take a look at what we're seeing happening now, where the Russians are bombing in Syria, and they were supposed to be attacking ISIS, and they are not.
Well, we've been talking about that throughout the program, and I know you must, as do your colleagues and my other guests, regard this as a very troubling development that Russia is moving into this void, as well as, it seems, an emboldened Iran. And I know you were opposing this nuclear deal with Iran. Any thoughts as to whether this might warrant or perhaps create conditions under which there might be a revisiting of the idea of giving $150 billion to this Iranian-Russian axis?
I think you would see Congress take that up in a heartbeat. I'm not so sure about the Senate, but certainly the House would. I don't know if the president's willing to go in that direction. He considers this deal his baby, just as he does the Affordable Care Act, and he doesn't seem to want to budge from it. And we're going to continue to put things up to try to get in the way of it. The Victims of Iranian Terrorism Act is one, where we have had victims that were awarded settlements that they need to receive, and it's supposed to come from the sanction money. Instead, we're turning it back to the terrorists and to a terrorist nation, and it makes no sense. We're going to continue to try and whittle away here at the House at this deal. But, you know, to me, it seems there's an axis of evil, or at least an anti-American axis that is very much forming. You can take Iran, China, Russia, and, you know, it was interesting that the president said to Mitt Romney, you need to call the 1980s and get your foreign policy back. Well, maybe it's time that he make that phone call.
And you know, this really is such an important point, Congressman Brad Winthrop, that we're looking at an environment in which, as I talked about earlier in the program with Congressman Stewart and Ralph Peters, we're actually incentivizing this kind of axis of evil, if you will, to emerge and to act aggressively against us. Before I lose your window here, Congressman, let me turn to one other place that's of great concern. And it actually involves the Department of Energy, which, of course, is responsible for several key nuclear programs in support of the United States military, the Naval Reactors Program, and, of course, our nuclear weapons material. Your district, or state at least, has got a facility in it that the DOE has just announced they're going to close that's responsible for a key part of that support function. Talk about that and what's at stake.
Well, there's a lot at stake, and it's a great national security risk, and it was done very poorly. Congress has been very much involved in wanting to keep this facility open and running to be able to provide the only domestic source of uranium enrichment that our military needs. And, you know, when it comes to military, it's very difficult, and especially something this scientific, to just shut it down and think you can turn it back on in a heartbeat. And so we're sending another message to our enemies that America's letting their readiness slip. They're letting it go. And this was done very poorly because there were reports on what was taking place as a type of demonstration and operations that were taking place in Piketon, Ohio, which is in my district. The reports were we were supposed to get to Congress from the DOE by April. They've made their decision to do this based on these reports, and we have yet to get those reports and even have a chance to weigh in on it. So people are losing their jobs. We're shutting down our only domestic source of uranium enrichment, which is vital to our national security. And you couldn't come at a worse time. It just sends one more signal to our adversaries that we're weak and takes away jobs.
What do we do without it, Congressman? I mean, if it is the only site, what does the Naval Nuclear Reactor Program do for enriched uranium to power its submarines and aircraft carrier reactors? What does the nuclear deterrent do for enriched uranium?
Well, they're claiming that it can stand on its own with our surplus, which are supplies. You know, in this day and age, with terrorism the way it is, I don't think we take that risk.
I don't think we should take that risk, but it's especially a risk that we seem to be taking without much public debate or scrutiny. And this is why it's so important that you and your colleagues are raising a ruckus about it, and we're very anxious to learn more. Keep us posted, if you would, on this, Congressman Brad Wenstrup. Let me just ask you very quickly in closing, one other issue that we've been talking about throughout the program is, as a member of the Intelligence Committee, your thoughts on this idea of contracting out inspection of the Iran deal to the International Atomic Energy Agency. Several of our guests have expressed real concern about that. In light of what we've seen just recently, how do you feel with sort of self-sampling by the Iranians?
Well, I think that that's ridiculous. I mean, who gets to correct their own test? And there's certainly nothing that Iran has done since 1979 that would make us feel that they can be trusted in any way, shape, or form on this. And we don't even have access to what this process is really all about in the deal, which is why in the House we said that it would gave a sense of the House disapproval of the deal. And we said we haven't gotten all the information to take the vote that we were supposed to take on disapproval because we were supposed to take that vote 60 days after we got the entire deal. And John Kerry and the president haven't even seen the entire deal. We're leaving it up to other people.
It's scandalous. And I do hope that your efforts to impede it will work. Congressman Brad Wenstrup, thank you. I know we've got to let you go back to your day job, but keep up the good work. And thank you for your service, both in uniform and in the Congress of the United States. It's greatly appreciated. Next up, Claudia Rosette joins us. We'll talk with her about the UN more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where a relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260, The Answer.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back and joined by another of my all-time favorite people, Claudia Rosette, the journalist in residence at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies in Washington. She is also a columnist with Forbes.com and PJ Media. But she also brings to this portfolio of international affairs, national security, foreign policy, and the like, an extraordinary background as an investigative reporter and editorialist for the Wall Street Journal, among other publications. Claudia, it is a delight to have you with us, especially as you have been deep soaking, marinating, if you will, in the spectacle of the United Nations the past 10 days or so. Talk a little bit about the parade of dictators that we've seen traipsing through those quarters and what we heard from them.
Yes, sure. Good morning, Frank. The parade of dictators began on Monday with the opening of the UN general debate. First, we had the head of a democratic country, the United States. I mean, talking about the starring lineup here, President Obama, who the U.S. traditionally has one of the earliest speaking slots when this sort of 6 days, as it's playing out right now, of speeches from every member of the UN and then some begins. And then also on Monday came this parade of dictators who, what they have in common is that President Obama has really gone far during his term as president to enable and empower and encourage them. And what was this lineup? China, with its president fresh from a state dinner at the White House. Russia, President Putin, who 2 days later gave the U.S. 1 hour's notice that he was about to start bombing the positions of U.S.-backed rebels in Syria. Iran, whose president had, of course, in his pocket the UN-sealed Iran nuclear deal, which effectively outlines Iran's path to the bomb, whether they choose to cheat or just wait until it sunsets. And then Cuba, whose president Raul Castro came after President Obama announced last December that he had decided it was time to normalize relations with Cuba, and having obtained virtually nothing in the way of concessions for this, has sent Secretary of State John Kerry over to Havana, sort of in the middle of busy, as the Iran nuclear talks were being debated here, the Iran nuclear agreement that was being debated here, Secretary of State Kerry was rushing over to Havana to raise the U.S. flag. So that was the starring lineup. Now it's been followed by a great many more. Mugabe of Zimbabwe was later that day. And so on. But it has been this parade, Frank, at an institution where more than half the 193 member states are not free.
You know, and what makes this all the more astonishing, Claudia Rosette, and again, nobody really understands the workings of this institution and its malevolence really better than you, but here we have the UN fomenting yet another radical leftist program in the form now of these so-called sustainability goals. And I think most Americans have no idea of either the nature of the organization. I think they don't like it very much, but they don't really understand it as you do, needless to say. But the kind of implications agendas like this one can have. Talk a little bit about what's up with all of that.
Yeah, when you get to the bottom of all the polysyllabic words with which the UN festoons these plans, what we're basically talking about is global central planning. That's what's envisioned here. And, you know, central planning has really never worked out well. One of the morals of the 20th century was don't try it. It both beggars people, it leads to destitution, and it leads to bloody horrible doings, because the force required to try to make it work ends up requiring that people die because the government wants them to do things that they're not otherwise inclined to do. And that's one of the big agendas here. Now, this is something where when the U.S. buys into it, it becomes very dangerous, in part because the details become so complex and really boring that people don't follow it, you know, and yet great damage can be done from this. But also because when you get countries such as Russia or China saying, oh, you know, we back this, they're basically dictatorships. They're run by rulers, governments that can easily decide not to observe deals that they sign on to at the UN.
And routinely
Whereas
do.
The U.S. is much more constrained to do so. We're a country of laws. We're an open society, so people come and say, wait a minute, we gave our word. It's very easy to see. You know, right now, the world is pouring over Hillary Clinton's emails as they're being divulged by the State Department. You really don't see that happening in a place like China or Russia. Okay.
Needless to say, where presumably those unredacted emails actually reside. I think it almost certainly actually is going to beggar a lot of people, and for that matter, probably wind up with a lot of them being dead, as I fear will this energy agenda of President Obama, which kind of fits into this program, and of course the one he intends to sign, evidently without Senate advice and consent, in Paris in a couple of months' time, this global energy accord. What are your thoughts on that, Claudia?
We should be extremely worried about that, that is potentially an enormous cost. And as we were just saying, when the U.S. signs on to this kind of a deal, it's under enormous pressure to actually try and live up to it. We try to keep our word. When China says, as the president of China did recently when he was in Washington, oh, you know, well, we're going to do things like curb our carbon emissions. Now, first of all, the science behind this is not at all established. Actually, nobody knows precisely what really works here. And I would also suggest that the whole business of climate change, which used to be, let's see, the UN was first concerned about global cooling and then about global warming and then about any change in climate at all. And effectively, Frank, it's again, it boils down to what? They want to fine-tune the economy of the planet in order to try and fine-tune the climate. Again, it gets back to central planning. Frank, mankind has adapted to changes in climate through things like the invention of clothing, heating, homes, houses. Okay,
fire.
Climate has been changing since forever. And now this is, I suspect that in centuries to come, assuming there's still population on this planet, people will look back
there
and say, wow, that was medieval superstition.
Yeah,
but in the name of this, we're now about to see a big push by the administration, and President Obama may just try to override the normal processes as in this country, as he has done in so many cases by now.
Notably with Iran, most recently, of course.
Correct, where the Senate didn't even end up with a vote. And it could be so costly. What it does is get in the way of the economic adaptation that capitalism would otherwise provide to anything that comes along with the climate. In other words, it's so backwards.
It is indeed.
It's
upside
this terrible
down.
Needless cost. And that's what looms in Paris.
Claudia, very quickly, lastly, we had earlier this week the International Atomic Energy Agency accepting the results of, or the samples, I should say, that Iran provided for the Parchin facility. Is it wise for us to be reposing in this entity the responsibility of verifying this very bad deal with Iran?
No, it's terrible. And one of the requirements of any Iran nuclear deal should have been that no matter what the UN conventions, that Iran disclose things directly in such a way that the U.S. has complete, transparent, immediate access. The IAEA is a UN creature, and recall that for years under its Egyptian head, Mohammed al-Baradei, it sat on evidence about Iran, and there's every reason
and actually
to be
misrepresented
again.
Them. Yeah, and it does seem that new management, which started out rather robust, has gone the way of al-Baradei. Claudia, this is a subject for a longer conversation. We look forward to having it with you soon. In the meantime, keep up the terrific work you do at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, at Forbes, and of course at PJ Media. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.